Welcome to another episode of the Walk and Talk podcast. I'm Greg Johnson, and today is Wednesday, October 7th, 2020. The topic for this episode is going to be building custom computers, DIY projects, custom builds of different computer components, putting them together. And as I do in my episodes now, I'm trying to offer this summary at the beginning. This episode's going to be a little bit rambling, so I'll try to offer what I believe to be sort of an outline of what I'm going to cover. But basically, it is to go into a conversation about a recent post I created that outlined a list of components that would be compatible to assemble into a nice, powerful computer that's relatively small and relatively low cost. And to summarize the details, it was basically choosing a mini ITX motherboard, which is roughly 7 inches by 7 inches. And the screw holes sort of line up with the mounting for larger motherboards, but it's just like, it's the size and portion of the motherboard where all the little ports are on the back of a computer. You may know where the USB ports are and the video ports and such. So that's about, 6 inches or 7 inches there. And so that's basically the crux of this system, is to have this smallish, inexpensive motherboard and then choose a video processor, the AMD brand, because that tends to be less money than Intel. And AMD is on the rise, essentially, as a high-quality, low-cost, economical but powerful manufacturer of these processors. So basically, if you have that motherboard, and you can choose whichever company you want to go with as far as a motherboard manufacturer. There's Asus and Gigabyte and ROX, and I don't have all the names memorized, but there are probably a half a dozen name brand motherboard manufacturers, and they make these mini ITX motherboards. And they all roughly look the same. They kind of have to, because all the adapter connectors and components are in this 7-inch by 7-inch space. It's about 2 inches tall, I guess, an inch and a half. It's whatever the height is of those ports on the back of the computer. And by having this processor that has video capability, that means you basically don't need a video card. And the motherboard has a removable, or a plug-in, a spot where you can put in a solid-state hard drive that looks like a stick of gum. It's pretty small. And then, the cost ends up being relatively low. The specific configuration I went with included kind of a nicer power supply, because I wanted selectively removable or usable power cables. And in this simple situation, they're really like a couple of cables that are needed, so you don't need to have a whole bundle of wires coming out of a power supply. You just need to have basically two cords running to two different places on the motherboard. So that's the summary. And the article I wrote up is on Resources for Life, but I'm hesitant to give, specifics about models and such, because I want this podcast episode to be relevant, months or years from now. So the general idea is to go with this small form factor motherboard and choose the processor that... Oh, the other thing about this AMD processor is that the Ryzen brand, or I guess it's AMD, but they have their brands of different model lines of processors, but this Ryzen one, it comes with a fan as well. And that may seem like a simple thing that you could just buy separately, but it's kind of nice to have it lined up. You know that it's going to bolt right down to the motherboard, and the fan is sort of small profile compared to others. Some of these cooling assemblies are huge. So at this point, I hope the introduction has, that sort of summary has given you a bit of an outline of what I'm going to dive into in more detail. here in the first few minutes. The other, I guess, consideration that I'll go into more detail on later is the cost of this. You know, it's about $600. Maybe if you really went with like a cheaper power supply and less memory, smaller hard drive, you could probably bring that down to maybe $500 or $450. But because the motherboard is about $150 and or maybe $120 or whatever, you know, that's the price range. And then the processor is going to be kind of the same, like $120, $140, you know. Pretty quickly it adds up to $300 just for those components. So there's going to be a cost. There's no getting around it. There's going to be a cost for memory. There's going to be a cost for some sort of hard drive. And there's going to be a cost for some kind of power supply. And those can, at the low end, could run kind of $50 to $60 each. But basically, you're going to want to take like a slight step up and get four times the amount of storage or twice the memory, etc. And at that price point, though, the comfortable $650 price point, and this is just the CPU box, you know, on the floor. It doesn't include the keyboard, mouse, and monitor. Those are going to be a separate cost. And I didn't mention the case. You'd probably want a nice case, and those inexpensive cases might be $50, but really to get a nice one, you'd want sort of $80 to $100. In having this smaller motherboard, it means you can get a smaller case and you don't need as big of a power supply. So a lot of the components cost less because you're starting out with this small, efficient powered motherboard. But before I get into more of the details then, let's just talk a little bit about cost. There's so many people I work with who, they have a budget that they're working with and their financial priorities are elsewhere. They don't want to spend, you know, $700 on a desktop computer or a laptop. I suppose a laptop of equivalent power might be $1,000, you know. And if they decided to go with an Apple computer, it could be $1,200 on up to, you know, $5,000 or something. So, but a lot of people, they just have other things they're doing with their life. They don't want to spend a lot of time and money on computers. And so many people opt for just getting a lightly used Windows 10 computer, you know. You can get those for $150, $200, a complete system maybe, with the Windows installation media in case you need to reinstall. You can get all of that and spend, yeah, maybe a couple hundred dollars. And so why would somebody want to go to the trouble of either buying a pre-built machine or building their own machine when most people's needs don't really warrant that? And I would say most people's needs, if we're looking at email, browsing the web, maybe organizing some photos, sharing some things on social media perhaps, or even better, you know, having direct email interactions with people, that's a little more personable. But that can be done with, you know, a three-year-old, five-year-old computer. And it really goes back to what people do, for example, when buying a car. You could save a lot of money, get a very reliable car, comfortable, works fine, that's 3 years old and has 36,000 miles or whatever, roughly, you know. You don't pay that premium for having the latest thing. You don't pay the premium for having the newest thing. And if you can go through life every, you know, 3 to 5 years getting a new one of these cars, or maybe getting the three-year-old car and using it for 10 years or something, you can save a lot of money. Well, the same thing's true for computers. If you don't have to have the latest off-the-shelf computer, you can get a used computer and it'll work quite well. The suggestion I have for people that are getting into buying a used desktop computer, for example, would be to upgrade the RAM. The RAM is the memory in the computer, and an older computer might not have enough by today's standards. So you'd want to upgrade that perhaps to 8 gigabytes or 16 gigabytes. would be adequate by today's standards, October 2020. Or go higher if you want, particularly if you're getting a used computer that has a slower processor. You can make up for that by having extra RAM. And then another thing is, if you're getting a used desktop computer, if it doesn't already have a solid state hard drive in it, then that would be another thing to install. And it's a good starting place, because when you install a solid state hard drive in a used computer, you would want to reinstall Windows 10. And by reinstalling Windows 10, it gives you an opportunity to experience that process, starting from, you know, nothing on a hard drive and walking through the setup. So it gives you a bit more confidence about the computer you're using. You know that you're familiar with going from just a computer hardware with nothing installed to running Windows. And then there's less mystery behind, how does that happen? How does that work? So you've done that. And the other advantage of that is, if you're using someone else's computer, a used computer, you would want to make sure that you're not inheriting any malware or other information that you just wouldn't want to have on there. And if it's a used computer, it may even at this point in time have a mechanical hard drive on it, which means it'll be slow and susceptible to mechanical crashes. There can still be corruption of files or system files on a solid state drive, but it's less of a problem, because at least you don't have to worry about mechanical failures. So anyway, that's a scenario. You buy this $150 to $200 used computer, you upgrade the RAM, put in a solid state drive. Now you have something that's just blazing fast. You click and things happen instantaneously. So I mention that, even though it in some ways doesn't relate to building your own computer at home, it does relate, because it's part of the context of what's out there, and a person needs to know it's another option, and it's an option that might save you time and money and work pretty well. So anyway, there's that. And then there are also, you know, if you're looking at building a computer and you price all the parts out, like I mentioned earlier, about $650, let's say, for some nice components, well, you can find a Dell computer that's already built with an Intel processor instead of an AMD. And it's about the same price, maybe $700 or something. So it's important to know what else is out there. If you're building a computer thinking that you're going to be saving a lot of money, you may want to think again, because when these manufacturers like Dell buy 10,000 hard drives for the computers they're going to sell that year, or, you know, 10,000 video cards or whatever, they're getting everything so inexpensive. And then they're paying people, hopefully a living wage, but, you know, a relatively small amount of money in a very efficient assembly environment. So they're just pumping out hundreds, or, I don't know, maybe thousands of computers a day. So you're not going to be able to compete with that in terms of the amount of time, you know, the labor and the cost for the parts. You're just not going to be able to be as efficient financially in building a computer, but it's fun. It's fun, and you get to specifically pick what components you want to use. So for somebody that does want to build a gaming computer, they can pick a particular video card they want. Or in the example I'm giving, if you know you want this smaller size computer that's going to be at the low end of cost for the hardware, then you might want to assemble your own. So there's buying used, there's buying pre-built, and then getting to the topic of this episode, which is custom building a computer. There's one other consideration that I think should be mentioned in the context of this before you would dive in and start buying a bunch of components. I mentioned that, you know, the motherboard might cost $150. You can get a computer with the power supply, the fan, the case, you know, everything you need, the memory, the storage. You can get a computer where the entire computer costs $150 instead of $700. And that computer is called a Raspberry Pi. The version now is the Raspberry Pi 4, and it comes in a variety of configurations, you could say. The computer itself, it's just a little board that's no bigger than your hand. There's one with 2 gigabytes, another with 4 gigabytes, another with 8 gigabytes. 8 gigabytes would be plenty of memory. That's the one that's about $150 when you get a kit. And you'd save maybe $30 if you went with the 4 gigabyte model. So what's the catch? Well, with the Raspberry Pi computer in its current rendition, it goes together pretty well. You get these parts that come in a box that you order on Amazon or wherever you buy it. And you would assemble, you'd put the motherboard in the case, the enclosure, and you'd put some heat sinks, heat dissipating, like aluminum fins that help dissipate heat from, there are three components that can heat up the processor, the memory, and the video component. A little fan goes on top, but it's really kind of a cool thing. And it runs what some people would call a limited version of Linux, but it does fine. It comes with LibreOffice, so that's a free equivalent to Microsoft Office. It has database, spreadsheet, word processing, presentation software. And this Raspberry Pi can have access to some free software like Thunderbird as an email client, which works really well. Some people would say better than Microsoft Outlook. So it's important to know that this is out there, that this exists. It's not Windows, so you can't run your typical Windows software on it. And for some people, that would be a deal breaker. They really need to run some particular program that's only available for Windows. But part of the motivation for people who are getting this $150 Raspberry Pi computer is that it's sort of like self-imposed minimalism. It's kind of like people who start living in the tiny houses that you've probably heard about, the tiny house movement, little houses on wheels. They look like nice garden sheds, and some of them are as big as RVs. But when you move into one of these tiny houses, you're pretty much, you really have to go down your inventory of what you're going to have, because there's not room for everything in there. It's like, you know, 200 square feet or less, or more, whatever you want. But in a small space like that, it really kind of forces you to become very minimalist. You have a little space where you're going to do some work and a tiny kitchen, and, you know. So the Raspberry Pi kind of does that to a person's digital life. You're not going to have 1,000 apps. You're not going to be having these like pop-ups and announcements and, you know, Facebook and all that going on. It's just your basic computing, which is really like 90 or maybe 100% of what people need. If you can check your email and get on the web and work with some photos, unless you're, you know, creating video content. I mean, that can be done also, but basically the essential tasks can be done with this computer. So a person has to ask themselves, if they can get a used Windows computer for $150 to $200, or one of these fun little low power, energy efficient, high performing power Raspberry Pi computers, why would somebody spend money to buy an assembled $700 computer or build their own $700 computer? And I already touched on that a little bit. So just know that that's the landscape. Used computers, brand new Raspberry Pi computers, other things. Okay. So when I was configuring this particular build, I've done others in the past using a full-size motherboard. And by full-size motherboard, I mean one that is not 7 inches in width or length or whatever you might say. The wider motherboards beyond the plugins, where you'd plug in your mouse and keyboard and Ethernet and all of that, to the right of all that you might notice on most computers, there are slots where you can plug in video cards or other types of interface cards. And some computers have four or five slots there. And if there's some project you're working on that really requires you to plug in some other card in there, well, then you'd want one of those huge motherboards. But most people don't need that. And so for this project, I was looking for something that would be relatively low power, relatively small amount of space. And I keep saying low power. What I mean to convey is low power usage, so more energy efficient. I was looking to build something like that. And this particular configuration really meets the goals that I had. So now, here toward the end of this episode, getting into the details of the components and assembly, basically we're starting with this motherboard that is compliant and compatible with the AMD processor. We're choosing the processor that has video capability built in so that there's HDMI output on the motherboard, and there's also DisplayPort output on the ports that come with this motherboard. So those are functional if you have a CPU that provides graphics video capability. They don't work if you don't have the right CPU to do that. And in that case, you'd need to get an additional video card. So anyway, starting with that, and when assembling this, some of the components are probably more easily installed on the board before it's put in the case. Once it's in the case, it's kind of hard to get your hands in there, and screws can drop and fall and stuff. So it's easier to kind of work with the motherboard on some sort of non-static pad or something. When installing the processor is maybe like an inch and a half by an inch and a half or something. It's just this little piece of metal with lots of tiny pins on one side. And those pins are supposed to line up, and then it drops down into this receptacle area on the motherboard. And then there's a lever that you use to, the lever will be in the up position when you're putting the chip in, and then you're pushing the lever down to sort of tighten the contacts between the processor and the motherboard. And so you do that, and then this cooling assembly, which is really a fan and then some fins that help dissipate heat. It's a very efficient system and relatively quiet, low power consumption fan. That gets bolted to the motherboard. And some of these motherboards, when you look at them, you'll see there are four holes that are around the processor, four holes for mounting. But some motherboards have some little plastic pieces there for, you know, there's probably, it's a universal like fan mount system. But the fan that comes with the AMD processor does not use those little plastic pieces. So you'll just remove those and then insert the fan assembly. There's a flat piece of metal on the underside of where these heat dissipating fins are. And that has, you wouldn't notice it. If you glance at it, you wouldn't notice it. But if you touch it, you'll find out that it has a paste on it. It's a lightly colored paste, and so you don't want to touch it. That is supposed to come in direct contact with the processor. And it helps create a smooth, even contact between the cooling fins and the processor, and transfer the heat from the processor into these fins. And it's similar in principle. If you took a frozen piece of food from the freezer and you started cooking that in a pan, and they're these little sausage patties that are from a company called Morningstar. They're like actually vegetarian sausage patties. But just like a sausage patty, it has like little bumps and dips in it. And so when you set this frozen piece of food on a skillet, there are only a very few contact points from that little piece of food onto the skillet. But if you put oil in the pan and then you put this in the pan, the oil fills in all those little gaps. So now basically that little piece of sausage is in direct contact with the pan and it cooks faster. There's a transfer of heat that's much faster when you have oil in the pan. Well, that's what this heat paste, thermal paste does, is the heat just transfers very quickly from the processor to these fins. The fan blowing helps get that heat away from the fins. And it works really well to keep it cool. And as long as you're not gaming nonstop at maximum computing power, you know, for 16 hours a day, you're not going to need like a liquid cooling system for your computer. You're not going to be overclocking the processor and risking that it get damaged, etc. You're just kind of doing normal day-to-day tasks. So, that's the deal with that. And the only other things that you'd need to kind of connect in on that motherboard would be the memory chips. And I'm not going to try to describe that in this episode, but there's some long slots where memory chips go in. Usually there's just two of them in one of these smaller motherboards. There might be four in a larger motherboard. So you'd put the two chips in the motherboard for your memory, preferably. Some motherboards are just going to have, you could just maybe install one memory chip and that'd be fine. But I'm recommending more memory and thus two chips. And then the other thing is, it's great to get a motherboard that has this M.2 connector. So, you know how traditional hard drives are kind of big metal things, and then the solid state hard drives are smaller. They're about the size of a smartphone. But the newest, as of October 2020, the current newest thing is a hard drive that's not much bigger than a stick of gum, and it kind of looks like a memory chip, and it basically just inserts on the motherboard. It's called NVMe hard drive technology, solid state. You'd install it. You get a lot more storage and a lot more speed for a lot less money. So it really kind of makes other hard drives obsolete at this point. And if your motherboard has that built in, and if it has video built in, well, now we're talking about fewer and fewer things that you have to kind of have a big computer case for or attach things to. So now we have the processor, the memory, the M.2 connected NVMe solid state hard drive. And the only thing at this point we're lacking is that we need to get power to the processor and power to the motherboard. So that is done with the power supply. The one that I'm recommending, and something similar will be available probably a year, 2 years, 3 years from now, but the idea is that you have these modular cables. So instead of having a bundle of cables coming out of a power supply that would be probably fine for a larger computer where you actually have a use for all those cables, instead of that, I like the idea of, instead of paying, you know, $50 for power supply, maybe pay $100 for power supply, get one that has these modular cables, and then you'll just use there's a 24-pin connector typically that goes to the motherboard to power all of the different components on the motherboard. It's kind of standardized now. And then there's an 8-pin connector that goes up closer to where the processor is, and that one powers the CPU. And if you wanted to, it would be kind of fun just to have this motherboard mounted on the wall or under your desk or in some sort of plexiglass stand or something that you drill little mounting holes in. And there are a lot of ways to display something like this. In the configuration that these components that I selected and listed, there's a case that's under $100. And it's from a company called NZXT. It's the micro ITX case. in white. It's just a nice, small, clean case. It's easy to work with. It's quite a bit bigger than 7 inches by 7 inches. So you're, you know, getting a slightly larger space to be used. But it helps protect the components. Presumably it reduces the amount of RF emissions sort of radiating from the electronics, and it gives everything sort of a place to be bolted in. And then the power supply would go in the bottom of this. And the other advantage of having a case of some kind, if it's designed properly, is that there are generally airflow inputs and airflow exhaust designed into the case. The power supply typically is bringing in air from outside of the case. The air flows over the power supply's hot components and gets exhausted at that point inside the computer. There are fans in the case that blow air out either toward the back or upward, so that the hot air that's accumulating near the processor and near the power supply, those are two areas that get hot, that air gets exhausted. And it should be coming in from, let's say, the front of the computer and being dissipated out the back of the computer. That way the air input is a little bit of a distance away from the exhaust. Otherwise you'd be, you know, bringing in the same hot air that you just exhausted out the back. Some computer cases are not designed well. They have air intakes that are right next to the air exhaust, and so it's just hot air cycling around until the thing overheats. So anyway, with a nice case, you can get something that's visually attractive, that protects your components, and provides you with some usually solid, easily accessible plugins on the front, and more easily visual power button on the front of the computer. And that's basically it. You know, you plug in these components. I would say with the power supply, if you are using that in the case, as I was suggesting, you would put that in the bottom. You would run these two cords that you're needing for the motherboard and the CPU, and you'd route those through the case up to the area where the motherboard is, because the power supply is in a different location than the motherboard. So you wouldn't want to have those wires attached before putting the motherboard in the case, because you'd need to take them apart anyway. So anyway, and then the motherboard will just basically sit in the case. You may need to kind of angle it in with the back edge first. So the edge that has those ports on it, that'll go toward the back of the case. Some motherboards have a built-in metal cover over the ports that has descriptive indicators for what each port is. It might be color-coded. It has little cutouts for each port. So some motherboards just have that built in and included on the motherboard. In many other installations, what you do is you would take that flash surface, that panel, and you would install it on the motherboard opening, and then put your install that on the case opening in the back, and then you would put your motherboard in, and the plugins would line up with the cutouts on that metal panel that you've inserted there. And then you just put in four screws and the motherboard's in there. And because we don't have to install a video card and we don't have to install hard drives, that's fewer data cables running around, fewer power cords running around inside there. At that point, it's just motherboard goes in, tighten four screws, connect the two sort of wire bundles. One is the 24-pin for the motherboard and the other is the 8-pin for the CPU. And you probably will have some other connectors from the case for the USB in the front, maybe some hard drive activity indicator lights, maybe a reset button, maybe some other things, audio. And there is usually a front panel patch connector, either all bundled into one little plug-in, which is great, or little wires, but they're labeled, and the motherboard should be labeled. So you'd connect those little wires to the motherboard where it's indicated. You might need to check out the instructions for that. But basically what that does then is these little metal posts, metal wires, metal contacts that are coming up from the motherboard that are labeled, one will say power, for example. And there will be two little pins there. And you'll take these wires, probably a black and a red one, and one goes on one post and the other goes on the other post, and it's probably labeled ground or negative. You put the black one there. And that's probably the trickiest part of all this, because it may not be completely lined up so you can just plug in one little plastic plug and have everything connected. It just depends on your setup. So once you have the front panel plugins and audio and power connected to the motherboard, and you have the power supply connected to the motherboard, then you can power on the computer. And you should be able to connect a video display and a keyboard and a mouse. And the first thing you would see coming up on the screen would be the BIOS, the hardware configuration screen, that is information being displayed from the computer motherboard itself. And then after that, you'd have an opportunity to install an operating system. You could install Linux. There's a version of Linux called Ubuntu, which is quite nice. Most people would want to go with Windows 10. And what I've found for the easiest installation and inevitable subsequent reinstallations is to use a Microsoft Windows 10 installation USB. It's about $140 retail, but Microsoft, well, at least on Amazon, I saw it recently for $120. But basically, that's the price range for that. You could order it on Amazon or order it directly through Microsoft. And I say that's the easiest thing because the other possible avenues to get this done would be to download what's called an ISO and burn that to a DVD, but then you'd need a DVD drive, or you'd have to create a bootable USB. All that's kind of complicated. So if you get this one from Microsoft, it's just Windows 10 installation, it comes with the license key. And that's really handy. So if you ever need to reinstall because of a virus or some corrupted files or whatever, you can easily do that. And that's about it. Of course, that's kind of an overview. More details would need to be, you know, researched online for the specifics, but that's the general build. And the reasons for going that route, as I mentioned, just to save time, save money, save on space, and have a powerful computer. The processor I mentioned that has the graphics capability, it's a 4-core, so it's not going to be as fast or high performing as a 6-core or 8-core or above, but it does have the convenience of having the video capability in there. As far as the display, you could really, you know, hook up any new or used computer display as long as it has HDMI, and that would also work with a TV that has HDMI. I would recommend a 42-inch 4K Samsung television as your computer display. 42 inches used to be what we might call a big screen TV. Now it's just kind of a small TV, but it's perfect size for a desktop to get a lot of viewing space. And alternatively, you could probably find some other displays that would work. The reason I like the 42-inch display is that, you know, a lot of people are going with dual displays, so they'll get like a 27-inch or 30-inch, 32-inch computer display, and they'll get two of those and put them side by side, but why do that? You know, why not just have one large 42-inch display and you're done? And the cost is possibly lower. I mean, you can get a 42-inch 4K display now for a few hundred dollars probably. And there are other brands to go with. There are some that are not as well known as, let's say, Sony or LG or Samsung, but you can still go with something like that and probably work fine. Another reason to build your own computer and to build a desktop computer, a simple one, is that if any of these components fail, you've built it. You can replace any failed components. You'll have that skill and that memory of where things go and how to take it apart. If it's a laptop computer, or if it's a very compact, specialized Dell computer or something like that, some of those components might not be very easy to get to and might not be easy to replace. The computer that we've been talking about here in the episode is a computer that uses standard interchangeable parts. The power supply, the motherboard, the case. You know, if the case got dented and scratched and you wanted to replace it, or you just wanted to change the style, you could move your components to another case. If the power supply went out, maybe there was a surge or lightning strike, you needed to replace the power supply, no problem. Any power supply would fit as long as it's this sort of generic size. Similarly with the memory, even the processor, if you decided you wanted to make the computer run faster, you could expand it by getting a faster processor. So there are these options that are available when you've built your own computer using sort of standard size parts. And that's something that wouldn't be available if you had a laptop computer or a store-bought like HP or Sony or Dell or something that had specialized parts. And because of that, it's potentially better for the environment because you're not going to be throwing away a computer that doesn't work. You'll be fixing it. And you'll not be throwing away a computer that needs to be upgraded because you can upgrade it. A lot of computers and technology being manufactured today is being manufactured in a way that's designed to make it difficult to work on, difficult to repair, difficult to upgrade. So that compels you to go buy something new. So it's harmful to your pocketbook. It's harmful to the environment. It's just not a good thing. So why not just step away from all that and build something that's really going to offer better longevity of use? I think that's a good way to go. Particularly with laptop computers. I used to be a real fan of laptop computers because, with Dell, for example, there would be this little access panel on the bottom, and you just take a screw out or maybe two screws, and you could pull out the hard drive, or you could open up another panel with a couple of screws and upgrade the memory. But otherwise, laptops are not very user-friendly for cleaning them or replacing a fan or fixing something. They're pretty difficult to work on, and they're not really designed to be used for extended periods of time. They're designed to be used as a temporary portable solution. And I remember once opening up some Dell laptops that a business had purchased, and I was getting those set up, and there was a warning that came with these Dell laptops, and it said, these computers are not intended to be used all day long. They're not intended to be a replacement for a desktop computer. They're intended to be a temporary portable device. And they used those computers every day, all day, and it worked out okay. But essentially, Dell was wanting to cover their bases and not be responsible for computers getting filled up with dust or overheating because they didn't have proper ventilation or whatever. But with a desktop computer, you don't need to worry about that. So most people are sitting at home, working at a desk in one location, and a desktop computer is fine. And for the portable tech needs that we have, smartphones are increasingly filling that void. So if you're on the go and you want to take care of a couple of emails, you can do that and a lot more with a smartphone, much better than with, you know, trying to carry around some clunky laptop computer that's expensive and could break and makes it easy to, difficult to repair. And in that regard, if you're making this decision about building a desktop, you know, you can get these really nice, relatively small keyboards, Bluetooth keyboards, that can work with your smartphone. And that really, for most people, takes the place of needing a laptop. What they really, you know, as I talk to people, I say, what do you want to do when you're portable? They say, well, just, you know, type emails. And if they had access to a keyboard that connected to their smartphone, well, then that would serve that purpose. So anyway, it's good to kind of step back, look at the big picture, think holistically, think about what your needs are and what the outcomes are. So if your needs are really just doing email and surfing the web, watching some videos, you know, all that can be well served by having relatively inexpensive or somewhat more expensive custom-built desktop, and then have your portable computer be your phone, or just an inexpensive old Windows laptop that you carry around from time to time but doesn't have all your files on it and isn't your primary go-to computer. So, that's basically it. A couple of other points, actually, now that I'm thinking of it, is when you're looking at motherboards, you might want to get one that has Bluetooth capability and that has Wi-Fi capability built in, and some little, you know, antennas that stick out, or an antenna that attaches somehow, because then you're set for whatever situation you might run into. If you need to have a wireless keyboard and mouse, you can use that with Bluetooth. If you're in a location where Ethernet is not easily available for Wi-Fi, maybe your internet's provided by your landlord or something like that, or you're just in a home where the router's in another room, you can use Wi-Fi. So that makes your computer a lot more compatible with different situations. Well, thanks for taking time to listen to this episode. I appreciate all the comments, questions, feedback, the special requests that come in for show topics, the subscriptions, shares, and all of that. And I look forward to sharing more with you again soon. Take care.